He was looking at her, patient and genial. She ran her hand through her short hair and nodded. Greg, then. And I'm Sarah. Tachyon sent me back here.
Great. This is Maryu, who was on the wrong end of somebody's knife.
Greg indicated the Joker, who stared at Sarah with unblinking, feral intensity. His pupils were reddish, and his lips were drawn back in a snarl. The Joker said nothing, either unwilling or unable to talk. I guess I should find something to do. Sarah looked around, wanting to leave.
I could use an extra pair of hands with Maryu here.
No, she wanted to say. I don't want to know you. I don't want to have to say I was wrong. Belatedly, Sarah shook her head. Okay. Sure. What do you want me to do? They worked together silently. The wound had been stitched earlier. Greg cleaned it gently as Sarah held the prickly barbs away. He smeared antibiotic ointment on the long wound, pressed gauze to it. Sarah noticed most that his touch was gentle, if clumsy. He bound the dressing and stepped back.
Okay, you're done, Maryu.
Greg patted the Joker carefully on the shoulder. The spiny face nodded slightly, then Maryu padded away without a word. Sarah found Greg looking at her, sweating in the heat of the clinic.
Thanks.
You're welcome. She took a step back from him, uncomfortable. You did a good job with Maryu. Greg laughed. He held out his hands, and Sarah saw angry red scratches scattered over them.
Maryu gave me lots of problems until you showed up. I'm strictly amateur help here. We made a good team, though. Tachyon wanted me to unload supplies. Want to give me a hand with that?
There wasn't a graceful way to say no. They worked in silence for a time, restocking shelves. I didn't expect to find you here, Sarah commented as they wrestled a packing crate into a storage room. Sarah saw that he noted her unspoken words and hadn't taken offense.
Without making sure a video camera was recording my good works, you mean?
He said, smiling.
Ellen was out shopping with Peregrine. John and Amy had a stack of paperwork this big they wanted me to tackle.
Greg held his hands 2 feet apart. Coming here seemed a lot more useful.
Besides, Tachyon's dedication can give you a guilt complex. I left a note for security saying I was going out. I imagine Billy Ray is probably having a fit by now.
Promise not to tell on me? His face was so innocently mischievous that she had to laugh with him. With the laughter, a little more of the brittle hatred flaked away. You're a constant surprise, Senator.
Greg, remember?
Softly. Sorry. Her smile faded. For a moment, she felt a strong pull to him. She forced the feeling down, denied it. It's not what you want to feel. It's not real. If anything, it's a backlash reaction for having detested him for so long. She looked around at the barren, dusty shelves of the storeroom and viciously tore open the carton. She could feel his eyes watching her.
You still don't believe what I said about Andrea?
His voice wavered halfway between statement and question. His words, so close to what she'd been thinking, brought sudden heat to her face. I'm not sure about anything.
And you still hate me?
No, she said. She pulled styrofoam packing from the box. And then, with sudden, impulsive honesty, to me that's probably more scary. The admission left her feeling vulnerable and open. Sarah was glad that she couldn't see his face. She cursed herself for the confession. It implied attraction for Greg. It suggested that, far from hating him, she'd come nearly full circle in her feelings,
And that was simply something she didn't want him to know. Not yet. Not until she was certain. The atmosphere between them was charged with tension. She searched for some way to blunt the effect. Greg could wound her with a word, could make her bleed with a look. What Greg did then made Sarah wish that she'd never seen Andrea's face on Succubus, that she hadn't spent years loathing the man. He did nothing. He reached over her shoulder and handed her a box of sterile bandages.
"I think they go on the top shelf," he said.
"I think they go on the top shelf." Puppet Man was screaming inside him, battering at the mind bars that held him in. The power ached to be loose, to tear into Sarah's open mind and feed there. The hatred that had rebuffed him in New York was gone. And he could see Sarah's affection. He tasted it, like blood salt, radiant, warm, vermilion. "So easy," Puppet Man moaned. "It would be easy. It's rich, full. We could make that an overwhelming tide. You could take her here. She would beg you for release. She would give you whatever you asked of her. Pain, submission, anything. Please." Greg could barely hold back the power. He'd never felt it so needy, so frantic. He'd known this would be the danger of the trip. Puppet Man, that power inside him, would have to feed. And Puppet Man only fed on torment and suffering, all the black, red, and angry emotions. In New York and Washington, it was easy. There were always puppets there, minds he'd found and opened so that he could use them later. Cattle, fodder for the power. There it was easy to slip away, unseen, to stalk carefully, and then pounce. Not here. Not on this trip. Absences were conspicuous and needed explanations. He had to be cautious. He had to let the power go hungry. He was used to feeding weekly. Since the plane left New York, he'd managed to feed only once, in Guatemala, too long ago. Puppet Man was famished. His need could not be held back much longer. "Later," Greg pleaded. "Remember Mariu? Remember the rich potency we saw in him? We touched him. We opened him. Reach out now. See, you can still feel him, only a block away. A few hours and we feed, but not with Sarah. I wouldn't let you have Andrea or Succubus. I won't let you have Sarah." "Do you think she'd still love you if she knew?" Puppet Man mocked. "Do you think she'd still feel affection if you told her? You think she would embrace you, kiss you, let you enter her warmth? If you really want her to love you for yourself, then tell her everything." "Shut up!" Greg screamed back. "Shut up! You can have Mariu. Sarah is mine." He forced the power back down. He made himself smile. It was 3 hours before he found an excuse to leave. He was pleased when Sarah decided to stay at the clinic. Shaking from the exertion of keeping Puppet Man inside, he went into the night streets. Santa Teresa, like Joker Town, was alive at night, still vibrant with dark life. Rio herself never seemed to sleep. He could look down into the city and see a deluge of lights flowing in the valleys between the sharp mountains and spilling halfway up the slopes. It was a sight to make one stop for a moment and ponder the small beauties that, unwittingly, a sprawling humanity had made. Greg hardly noticed it. The lashing power inside drove him. Mariu, feel him, find him. The Joker who had brought in the bleeding Mariu had spoken a little English. Greg overheard the story he told Tachyon. Mariu was crazy, he said. Ever since Kara was nice to him, he'd been bothering her. Kara's husband, Joao, had told Mariu to stay away, told him he was just a fucking joker. Said he'd kill Mariu if Mariu didn't leave Kara alone. Mariu wouldn't listen. He kept following Kara, scaring her, so Joao cut him. Greg had offered to dress Mariu's wound after Tachyon had stitched it up, feeling Puppet Man yammering inside. He'd touch the loathsome Mariu, let the power open his mind to feel the raging boil of emotions. He'd known immediately. This would be the one. He could sense the emanations of the open mind at the edge of his range, perhaps a half mile away. He moved through narrow, twisting streets, still dressed in the blues. Some of his intensity must have shown, for he wasn't bothered. Once a crowd of children surrounded him, pulling at his pockets, but he'd looked at them, and they'd gone silent, scattering into darkness. He'd moved on, closer to Mariu, until he saw the Joker. Mariu was standing outside a ramshackle three-story apartment building, watching a window on the second floor. Greg felt the pulsing black rage and knew that Zhuo was there. Mariu's feelings for Zhuo were simple, bestial. Those for Kara were more complex. A shifting, metallic respect, an azure affection laced through with veins of repressed lust. With his barbed skin, Mariu had probably never had a willing lover, Greg knew, but he could sense the fantasies in his mind. Now, please. Greg took a shuddering breath. He let down the barriers. Puppet Man laughed. He stroked the surface of Mariu's mind possessively, cooing softly to himself. He removed the few restraints an uncaring society and church had put on Mariu. Yes, be angry, he whispered to Mariu. Be full of devout rage. He keeps you from her. He insulted you. He hurt you. Let the fury come. Let it blind you until you see nothing but its burning heat. Mariu was moving restlessly in the street, his arms waving as if to some inner debate. Greg watched as Puppet Man amplified the frustration, the hurt, the anger, until Mariu screamed hoarsely and ran into the building. Greg closed his eyes, leaning against a shadowed wall. Puppet Man rode with Mariu, not seeing with Mariu's eyes, but feeling with him. He heard shouts in angry Portuguese, the splintering of wood, and suddenly the rage flared up higher than before. Puppet Man was feeding now, taking sustenance from the rampant emotions. Mariu and Zhuo were struggling, for he could sense deep underneath a sensation of pain. He damped the pain down so Mariu would not notice it. The screams of a woman accompanied the shouts now, and from the twisting of Mariu's mind, Greg knew that Kara was there too. Puppet Man increased Mariu's anger until the glare of it nearly blinded him. He knew Mariu could feel nothing else now. The woman screamed louder. There was a distinct, dull thud, audible even in the street below. Greg heard the sound of breaking glass and a wail. He opened his eyes to see a body strike the hood of a car and topple into the street. The body was bent at an obscene angle, the spine broken. Mariu was looking down from the window above. Yes, that was good. That was tasty. This will taste good as well. Puppet Man let the rage slowly fade as Mariu ducked back inside. Now he toyed with the feelings for Kara. He diluted the binding respect, let the affection dim. You need her. You've always wanted her. You looked at those hidden breasts as she walked by and wondered how they would feel all silken and warm. You wondered at the hidden place between her legs, how it would taste, how it would feel. You knew it would be hot, slick with desire. You'd stroke yourself at night and think of her writhing underneath you, moaning as you thrust. Now Puppet Man turned derisive, mocking, modifying passion with the residue of Mariu's anger. And you knew that she'd never want you. Not looking the way you do. Not the Joker with the needled quills. No, her body couldn't be for you. She'd laugh about you, making coarse jokes. When Zhuo possessed her, he'd laugh and say, this would never be Mariu. Mariu would never take pleasure from me. Kara screamed. Greg heard cloth tear and felt Mariu's uncontrolled lust. He could imagine it. He could imagine him bearing her down roughly, uncaring that his barbs gouged her unprotected skin, looking only for release, and imagine vengeance in the violent, agonizing rape. Enough, he thought quietly. Let it be enough. But Puppet Man only laughed, staying with Mariu until orgasm threw his mind into chaos. Then Puppet Man, sated himself, withdrew. He laughed hilariously, letting Mariu's emotions drop to normal. Let the Joker look in horror at what he'd done. Already there were more shouts from the building, and Greg heard the sirens in the distance. He opened his eyes, gasping, blinking, and ran. Inside, Puppet Man eased himself into his accustomed place and quietly let Greg place the bars around him. Satisfied, he slept.
Friday, December 26th, 1986, Syria. Misha sat bolt upright, sweat drenched from the dream. She had evidently cried out in fear, for Saeed was struggling to sit up in his own bed.
Wallah, woman, what is it?
Saeed was hewn from a heroic mold, fully 10 foot tall and muscled like a god. In repose, he was inspiring. A dark Egyptian giant, a myth given life. Saeed was the weapon in Nur Allah's hands. Terrorists, such as Al-Mu'azzin, were the hidden blades. When Saeed stood before the faithful, towering over all, they could see in Nur Allah's general the visible symbol of Allah's protection. In Saeed's keen mind were the strategies that defeated the better armed and supplied Israeli troops in the Golan Heights, when the world had thought Nur Allah and his followers hopelessly outnumbered. He had orchestrated the rioting in Damascus when Al-Assad's ruling Ba'ath party had tried to move away from the Quranic law, allowing the Nur sect to forge an alliance with the Sunni and Al-Wa'id sects. He craftily advised Nur Allah to send the faithful into Beirut when the Christian Druze leaders had threatened to overthrow the reigning Islamic party. When the swarm mother had sent her deadly offspring to earth the year before, it was Saeed who had protected Nur Allah and the faithful. In his mind was victory. For the jihad, Allah had given Saeed hikmah, divine wisdom. It was a well-kept secret that Saeed's heroic appearance was also a curse. Nur Allah had decreed that jokers were sinners, branded by God. They had fallen from Sharia, the true path. They were destined to be slaves of the true faithful at best. At worst, they would be exterminated. It would not have been wise for anyone to see that Nur Allah's brilliant strategist was nearly a cripple. That Saeed's mighty, rippling thews could barely support the crushing weight of his body. While his height had doubled, his mass had increased nearly fourfold. Saeed was always carefully posed. He moved slowly, if at all. When he must go any distance, he rode. Men who had seen Saeed in the baths whispered that he was as heroically proportioned everywhere. Misha alone knew that his manhood was as crippled as the rest of him. For the failure of his appearance, Saeed could only blame Allah, and he did not dare. For his inability to stay aroused more than a few moments, he blamed Misha. Tonight, as often, her body bore the livid bruises of his heavy fists. But at least the beatings were quick. There were times when she thought his awful, suffocating weight would never rise from her. "It is nothing," she whispered. "A dream. I didn't mean to wake you." Saeed rubbed at his eyes, staring groggily toward her. He had brought himself to a sitting position, and he panted from the effort.
"A vision, Nur Allah has said.
My brother needs his sleep, as does his general. Please."
"Why must you always oppose me, woman?"
Saeed frowned, and Misha knew that he remembered his earlier embarrassment, when in frustration he had battered her, as if he could find release in her pain.
"Tell me," he insisted. "I must know if it's something to tell the Prophet."
"I am Kahina," she wanted to say. "I am the one Allah has gifted. Why must you be the one to decide whether to wake Najib? It was not your vision." But she held back the words, knowing that they led to more pain.
"It was confused," she told him.
"I saw a man, a Russian by his dress, who handed Nur Allah many gifts. Then the Russian was gone, and another man, an American, came with more gifts and laid them at the Prophet's feet. Misha licked dry lips, remembering the panic of the dream. Then there was nothing but a feeling of terrible danger. He had gossamer strings knotted to his long fingers, and from each string dangled a person. One of his creatures came forward with a gift. The gift was for me, and yet I feared it, dreading to open the package. I ripped it open and inside, she shuddered. I saw only myself. I know there was more to the dream, but I woke. Yet I know. I know the gift bearer is coming. He will be here soon.
An American?
Said asked. Yes.
Then I know already. You dream of the plane carrying the Western infidels. The Prophet will be ready for them. A month, perhaps more.
Misha nodded, pretending to be reassured, though the terror of the dream still held her. He was coming, and he held out his gift for her, smiling. I'll tell Nur Allah in the morning, she said. I'm sorry I disturbed your rest.
There's more I would talk about,
Said answered. She knew. Please, we're both tired.
I'm entirely awake now.
Said, I wouldn't want to fail again. She had hoped that would end it, yet had known it would not. Said groaned to his feet. He said nothing. He never did. He lumbered across the room, breathing loudly at the exertion. She could see his huge bulk beside her bed, a darker shade against the night. He fell more than lowered himself atop her.
This time,
he breathed.
This time.
It was not this time. Misha didn't need to be Kahina to know that it would never be.
From the Journal of Xavier Desmond. December 29th, 1986. Buenos Aires. Don't cry for Jack, Argentina. Evita's bane has come back to Buenos Aires. When the musical first played Broadway, I wondered what Jack Braun must have thought, listening to Lupone sing of the Four Aces. Now, that question has even more poignance. Braun has been very calm, almost stoic, in the face of his reception here. But what must he be feeling inside? Perón is dead. Evita, even deader. Even Isabel, just a memory. But the Peronistas are still very much part of the Argentine political scene. They have not forgotten. Everywhere the signs taunt Braun and invite him to go home. He's the ultimate gringo. Do they use that word in Argentina, I wonder? The ugly but awesomely powerful American who came to the Argentine uninvited and toppled a sovereign government because he disapproved of its politics. The United States has been doing such things for as long as there has been a Latin America, and I have no doubt that these same resentments fester in many other places. The United States, and even the dread secret aces of the CIA, are abstract concepts, however, faceless and difficult to get a fix on. Golden Boy is flesh and blood, very real, and very visible. And here. Someone inside the hotel leaked our room assignments. And when Jack stepped out onto his balcony the first day, he was showered with dung and rotten fruit. He has stayed inside ever since, except for official functions. But even there, he is not safe. Last night, as we stood in a receiving line at the Casa Rosada, the wife of a union official, a beautiful young woman, her small dark face framed by masses of lustrous black hair, stepped up to him with a sweet smile, looked straight into his eyes, and spit in his face. caused quite a stir. And Senators Hartman and Lyons have filed some sort of protest, I believe. Braun himself was remarkably restrained, almost gallant. Digger was hounding him ruthlessly after the reception. He's cabling a write-up on the incident back to Aces and wanted a quote. Braun finally gave him something. "I've done things I'm not proud of," he said. "But getting rid of Juan Perón isn't one of them." "Yeah, yeah," I heard Digger tell him. "But how did you feel when she spit on you?" Jack just looked disgusted. "I don't hit women," he said. Then he walked off and sat by himself. Downs turned to me when Braun was gone. "I don't hit women," he echoed in his sing-song imitation of Golden Boy's voice, then added, "What a weenie." The world is too ready to read cowardice and betrayal into anything Jack Braun says and does, but the truth, I suspect, is more complex. Given his youthful appearance, it's hard to recall at times how old the Golden Boy really is. His formative years were during the Depression and World War II, and he grew up listening to the NBC Blue Network, not MTV. No wonder some of his values seem quaintly old-fashioned. In many ways, the Judas Ace seems almost an innocent, a bit lost in a world that has grown too complicated for him. I think he's more troubled than he admits by his reception here in Argentina. Braun is the last representative of a lost dream that flourished briefly in the aftermath of World War II and died in Korea and the HUAC hearings and the Cold War. They thought they could reshape the world, Archibald Holmes and his Four Aces. They had no doubts, no more than their country did. Power existed to be used, and they were supremely confident in their ability to tell the good guys from the bad guys. Their own democratic ideals and the shining purity of their intentions were all the justification they needed. For those few early aces, it must have been a golden age, and how appropriate that a golden boy be at its center. Golden ages give way to dark ages, as any student of history knows, and as all of us are currently finding out. Braun and his colleagues could do things no one else had ever done. They could fly and lift tanks and absorb a man's mind and memories. And so, they bought the illusion that they could make a real difference on a global scale. And when that illusion dissolved beneath them, they fell a very long way indeed. Since then, no other ace has dared to dream as big. Even in the face of imprisonment, despair, insanity, disgrace, and death, the Four Aces had triumphs to cling to, and Argentina was perhaps the brightest of those triumphs. What a bitter homecoming this must be for Jack Braun. As if this was not enough, our mail caught up with us just before we left Brazil, and the pouch included a dozen copies of the new issue of Aces with Digger's promised feature story. The cover has Jack Braun and Mordecai Jones in profile, scowling at each other, all cleverly doctored, of course. I don't believe the two had ever met before we all got together at Tomlin, over a blurb that reads, "The Strongest Man in the World." The article itself is a lengthy discussion of the two men in their public careers, enlivened by numerous anecdotes about their feats of strength and much speculation about which of the two is indeed the strongest man in the world. Both of the principals seem embarrassed by the piece. Braun, perhaps more acutely. Neither much wants to discuss it, and they certainly don't seem likely to settle the matter anytime soon. I understand that there has been considerable argument and even wagering back in the press compartment since Digger's piece came out. For once, Down seems to have had an impact on his journalistic colleagues. But the bets are likely to remain unresolved for a long time to come. I told Downs that the story was spurious and offensive as soon as I read it. He seemed startled. "I don't get it," he said to me. "What's your beef?" My beef, as I explained to him, was simple. Braun and Jones are scarcely the only people to manifest superhuman strength since the advent of the wild card. In fact, that particular power is a fairly common one, ranking close behind telekinesis and telepathy in Tachyon's incidence of occurrence charts. It has something to do with maximizing the contractile strength of the muscles, I believe. My point is, a number of prominent jokers display augmented strength as well. Just off the top of my head, I cited Elmo, the dwarf bouncer at the Crystal Palace, Ernie of Ernie's Bar and Grill, The Oddity, Quasiman, and, most notably, Howard Mueller. The troll's strength does not perhaps equal that of Golden Boy and the Harlem Hammer, but assuredly, it approaches it. None of these jokers was so much as mentioned in passing in Digger's story, although the names of a dozen other super strong aces were dropped here and there. Why was that, I wanted to know. I can't claim to have made much of an impression, unfortunately. When I was through, Down simply rolled his eyes and said, "You people are so damn touchy." He tried to be accommodating by telling me that if this story went over big, maybe he'd write up a sequel on the strongest joker in the world. And he couldn't comprehend why that concession made me even angrier. And they wonder why we people are touchy. Howard thought the whole argument was vastly amusing. Sometimes I wonder about him. Actually, my fit of pique was nothing compared to the reaction the magazine drew from Billy Ray, our security chief. Ray was one of the other aces mentioned in passing, his strength dismissed as not being truly major league. Afterward, he could be heard the length of the plane suggesting that maybe Downs would like to step outside with him, seeing as how he was so minor league. Digger declined the offer. From the smile on his face, I doubt that Carnifex will be getting any good press in Aces anytime soon. Since then, Ray has been grousing about the story to anyone who will listen. The crux of his argument is that strength isn't everything. He may not be as strong as Braun or Jones, but he's strong enough to take either of them in a fight, and he'd be glad to put his money where his mouth is. Personally, I've gotten a certain perverse satisfaction out of this tempest in a teapot. The irony is, they're arguing about who has the most of what is essentially a minor power. I seem to recall that there was some sort of demonstration in the early 70s when the battleship New Jersey was being refitted at the Bayonne Naval Supply Center over in New Jersey. The Turtle lifted the battleship telekinetically, got it out of the water by several feet, and held it there for almost half a minute. Braun and Jones lift tanks and toss automobiles about, but neither could come remotely close to what the Turtle did that day. The simple truth is, the contractile strength of the human musculature can be increased only so much. Physical limits apply. Dr. Tachyon says there may also be limits to what the human mind can accomplish, but so far, they have not been reached. If the Turtle is indeed a joker, as many believe, I would find this irony especially satisfying. I suppose I am at base as small a man as any.
The Tint of Hatred. Part 4. Thursday, January 1st, 1987, South Africa. The evening was cool. Beyond the hotel's wide veranda, the crumpled landscape of the Bushveld Basin seemed pastoral. The last light of the day edged grassy hills with lavender and burnt orange. In the valley, the sluggish Olifant's brown waters were touched with gold. Among the stand of acacias lining the river, monkeys settled to sleep with occasional hooting calls. Sarah looked at it and felt nausea. It was so damn beautiful, and it hid such a sickness. There had been enough trouble even keeping the delegation together in the country. The planned New Year's celebration had been wrecked by jet lag and the hassles of getting into South Africa. When Father Squid, Xavier Desmond, and Troll had tried to eat with the others in Pretoria, the head waiter had refused to seat them, pointing to a sign in both English and Afrikaans, "Whites only."
"We don't serve blacks, coloreds, or jokers," he insisted.
Hartman, Tachyon, and several of the other high-ranking members of the delegation had immediately protested to the Botha government. A compromise had been reached. The delegation was given the run of a small hotel on the Loskop Game Preserve. Isolated, they could intermingle if they wished. The government had let it be known that they also found the idea distasteful. When they had finally popped the champagne corks, the wine had tasted sour in all their mouths. The junket had spent the afternoon at a ramshackle kraal, actually little more than a shanty town. There they'd seen firsthand the double-edged sword of prejudice, the new apartheid. Once it had been a two-sided struggle, the Afrikaners and the English against the blacks, the colored, and the Asians. Now the jokers were the new Uitlanders, and both white and black spat upon them. Tachyon had looked at the filth and squalor of this joker town, and Sarah had seen his noble, sculptured face go white with rage. Greg had looked ill. The entire delegation had turned on the National Party officials who had accompanied them from Pretoria and begun to rail at the conditions here. The officials spouted the approved line. "This is why we have the Prohibition of Mixed Marriages Act," they said, pointedly ignoring the jokers among the group. "Without strict separation of the races, we will only produce more jokers, more colored, and we're sure none of you want that. This is why there's an Immorality Act, a Prohibition of Political Interference Act. Let us do things our way, and we will take care of our own problems. Conditions are bad, yes, but they are getting better. You've been swayed by the African Jokers National Congress. The AJNC is outlawed. Their leader Mandela is nothing more than a fanatic, a troublemaker. The AJNC has steered you to the worst encampment they could find. If the doctor, the senators, and their colleagues had only stayed with our itinerary, you would have seen the other side of the coin." All in all, the year had begun like hell. Sarah put a foot up on the railing, lowered her head until it rested on her hands, and stared at the sunset. Everywhere. Here you can see the problem so easily, but it's not really different. It's been horrible everywhere, whenever you look past the surface. She heard footsteps, but didn't turn around. The railing shuddered as someone stood next to her. "Ironic, isn't it? How lovely this land can be." Greg's voice.
"Just what I was thinking," Sarah said. She glanced at him, and he was staring out at the hills. The only other person on the veranda was Billy Ray, reclining against the railing a discreet distance away.
"There are times when I wish the virus were more deadly, that it had simply wiped the planet clean of us and started over," Greg said. "That town today." He shook his head. "I read the transcript you phoned in. It brought back everything. I started to get furious all over again. You've a gift for making people respond to what you're feeling, Sarah. You'll do more in the long run than I will. Maybe you can do something to stop prejudice. Here, and with people like Leo Barnett back home.
Thanks. His hand was very near hers. She touched it softly with her own. His fingers snared hers and didn't let her go. The emotions of the day, of the entire trip, were threatening to overwhelm her, her eyes stung with tears. Greg, she said very softly, I'm not sure I like the way I feel.
About today? The Jokers?
She took a breath. The failing sun was warm on her face. That, yes. She paused, wondering if she should say more. And about you, too, she added at last. He didn't say anything. He waited, holding her hand and watching the nightfall. It's changed so fast, the way I've seen you, Sarah continued after a time. When I thought that you and Andrea... She paused, her breath trembling. You care. You hurt when you see the way people are treated. God, I used to detest you. I saw everything that Senator Hartman did in that light. I saw you as false and empty of compassion. Now that's gone, and I watch your face when you talk about the Jokers and what we have to do to change things, and... She pulled him around so that they faced each other. She looked up at him, not caring that he'd see that she'd been crying. I'm not used to holding things inside. I like it when everything's out in the open. So forgive me if this isn't something I should say. Where you're concerned, I think I'm very vulnerable, Greg. And I'm afraid of that.
I don't intend to hurt you, Sarah.
His hand came up to her face. Softly, he brushed moisture from the corner of her eyes. Then tell me where we're heading, you and I. I need to know what the rules are. He stopped. Sarah, watching his face, saw an inner conflict. His head came down. She felt his warm, sweet breath on her cheek. His hand cupped her chin. She let him lift her face up, her eyes closing. The kiss was soft and very gentle. Fragile. Sarah turned her face away, and he brought her to him, pressing her body to his. Ellen, Sarah began.
She knows,
Greg whispered. His fingers brushed her hair.
I've told her. She doesn't mind.
I didn't want this to happen.
It did. It's okay,
he told her. She pushed away from him and was glad when he simply let her go. So what do we do about it? The sun had gone behind the hills. Greg was only a shadow, his features barely visible to her.
It's your decision, Sarah. Ellen and I always take a double suite. I use the second room as my office. I'm going there now. If you want, Billy will bring you up. You can trust him, no matter what anyone's told you about him. He knows how to be discreet.
For a moment, his hand stroked her cheek. Then he turned, walking quickly away. Sarah watched him speak briefly to Ray, and then he went through the doors into the hotel's lobby. Ray remained outside. Sarah waited until full darkness had settled over the valley and the air had begun to cool from the day's heat, knowing that she'd already made the decision, but not certain she wanted to follow it through. She waited, half looking for some sign in the African night. Then she went to Ray, his green eyes set disturbingly offline in an oddly mismatched face, seemed to look at her appraisingly.
"I'd like to go upstairs," she said.
From the Journal of Xavier Desmond. January 16th, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. A hard day in a stricken land. The local Red Cross representatives took some of us out to see some of their famine relief efforts. Of course, we'd all been aware of the drought and the starvation long before we got here. But seeing it on television is one thing, and being here amidst it is quite another. A day like this makes me acutely aware of my own failures and shortcomings. Since the cancer took hold of me, I've lost a good deal of weight. Some unsuspecting friends have even told me how good I look. But moving among these people made me very self-conscious of the small paunch that remains. They were starving before my eyes, while our plane waited to take us back to Addis Ababa, to our hotel, another reception, and no doubt a gourmet Ethiopian meal. The guilt was overwhelming, as was the sense of helplessness. I believe we all felt it. I cannot conceive of how Hiram Worcester must have felt. To his credit, he looked sick as he moved among the victims, and at one point, he was trembling so badly he had to sit in the shade for a while by himself. The sweat was just pouring off him. But he got up again afterward, his face white and grim, and used his gravity power to help them unload the relief provisions we had brought with us. So many people have contributed so much and worked so hard for the relief effort. But here, it seems like nothing. The only realities in the relief camps are the skeletal bodies with their massive swollen bellies, the dead eyes of the children, and the endless heat pouring down from above onto this baked, parched landscape. Parts of this day will linger in my memory for a long time, or at least as long a time as I have left to me. Father Squid gave the last rites to a dying woman who had a Coptic cross around her neck. Peregrine and her cameraman recorded much of the scene on film for her documentary, but after a short time she had had enough and returned to the plane to wait for us. I've heard that she was so sick, she lost her breakfast. And there was a young mother, no more than 17 or 18, surely, so gaunt that you could count every rib, with eyes incredibly ancient. She was holding her baby to a withered, empty breast. The child had been dead long enough to begin to smell, but she would not let them take it from her. Dr. Tachyon took control of her mind and held her still while he gently pried the child's body from her grasp and carried it away. He handed it to one of the relief workers and then sat on the ground and began to weep, his body shaking with each sob. Mistral ended the day in tears as well. En route to the refugee camp, she had changed into her blue and white flying costume. The girl is young, an ace, and a powerful one. No doubt she thought she could help. When she called the winds to her, the huge cape she wears fastened at wrist and ankle ballooned out like a parachute and pulled her up into the sky. Even the strangeness of the jokers walking between them had not awakened much interest in the inward-looking eyes of the refugees, but when Mistral took flight, most of them, not all, but most, turned to watch, and their gaze followed her upward into that high, hot blueness until finally they sank back into the lethargy of despair. I think Mistral had dreamed that somehow her wind powers could push the clouds around and make the rains come to heal this land. and what a beautiful, vainglorious dream it was. She flew for almost 2 hours, sometimes so high and far that she vanished from our sight. But for all her ace powers, all she could raise was a dust devil. When she gave up at last, she was exhausted. Her sweet young face, grimy with dust and sand, her eyes red and swollen. Just before we left, an atrocity underscored the depth of the despair here. A tall youth with acne scars on his cheeks attacked a fellow refugee, went berserk, gouged out a woman's eye, and actually ate it while the people watched without comprehension. Ironically, we'd met the boy briefly when we'd first arrived. He'd spent a year in a Christian school and had a few words of English. He seemed stronger and healthier than most of the others we saw. When Mistral flew, he jumped to his feet and called out after her. "Jet boy," he said in a very clear, strong voice. Father Squid and Senator Hartman tried to talk to him, but his English language skills were limited to a few nouns, including chocolate, television, and Jesus Christ. Still, the boy was more alive than most. His eyes went wide at Father Squid, and he put out a hand and touched his facial tendrils wonderingly, and actually smiled when the senator patted his shoulder and told him that we were here to help, though I don't think he understood a word. We were all shocked when we saw them carrying him away, still screaming. Those gaunt brown cheeks smeared with blood. A hideous day all around. This evening, back in Addis Ababa, our driver swung us by the docks, where relief shipments stand 2 stories high in some places. Hartman was in a cold rage. If anyone can make this criminal government take action and feed its starving people, he is the one. I pray for him, or would if I believed in a god. But what kind of god would permit the obscenities we have seen on this trip? Africa is as beautiful a land as any on the face of the earth. I should write of all the beauty we have seen this past month. Victoria Falls, the snows of Kilimanjaro, 1,000 zebra moving through the tall grass as if the wind had stripes. I've walked among the ruins of proud ancient kingdoms whose very names were unknown to me, held pygmy artifacts in my hand, seen the face of a bushman light up with curiosity instead of horror when he beheld me for the first time. Once, during a visit to a game preserve, I awoke early, and when I looked out of my window at the dawn, I saw that 2 huge African elephants had come to the very building, and Rada stood between them, naked in the early morning light, while they touched her with their trunks. I turned away then. It seemed somehow a private moment. Beauty, yes, in the land and in so many of the people whose faces are full of warmth and compassion. Still, for all that beauty, Africa has depressed and saddened me considerably, and I will be glad to leave. The camp was only part of it. Before Ethiopia, there was Kenya and South Africa. It is the wrong time of year for Thanksgiving, but the scenes we have witnessed these past few weeks have put me more in the mood for giving thanks than I've ever felt during America's smug November celebration of football and gluttony. Even jokers have things to give thanks for. I knew that already. But Africa has brought it home to me forcefully. South Africa was a grim way to begin this leg of the trip. The same hatreds and prejudices exist at home, of course. But whatever our faults, we are at least civilized enough to maintain a facade of tolerance, brotherhood, and equality under the law. Once, I might have called that mere sophistry, but that was before I tasted the reality of Cape Town and Pretoria, where all the ugliness is out in the open, enshrined by law, enforced by an iron fist whose velvet glove has grown thin and worn indeed. It is argued that at least South Africa hates openly, while America hides behind a hypocritical facade. Perhaps. Perhaps. But if so, I will take the hypocrisy and thank you for it. I suppose that was Africa's first lesson, that there are worse places in the world than Jokertown. The second was that there are worse things than repression. And Kenya taught us that. Like most of the other nations of Central and East Africa, Kenya was spared the worst of the wild card. Some spores would have reached these lands through airborne diffusion, more through the seaports, arriving via contaminated cargo in holds that had been poorly sterilized or never sterilized at all. Care packages are looked on with deep suspicion in much of the world, and with good reason. And many captains have become quite adept at concealing the fact that their last port of call was New York City. When one moves inland, wildcard cases become almost non-existent. There are those who say that the late Idi Amin was some kind of insane joker ace with strength as great as Troll or the Harlem Hammer, and the ability to transform into some kind of were-creature, a leopard or a lion or a hawk. Amin himself claimed to be able to ferret out his enemies telepathically, and those few enemies who survived say that he was a cannibal who felt human flesh was necessary to maintain his powers. All this is the stuff of rumor and propaganda, however. And whether Amin was a joker, an ace, or a pathetically deluded gnat madman, he is assuredly dead. And, in this corner of the world, documented cases of the wildcard virus are vanishingly hard to locate. But Kenya and the surrounding nations have their own viral nightmare. If the wildcard is a chimera here, AIDS is an epidemic. While the president was hosting Senator Hartman in most of the tour, a few of us were on an exhausting visit to a half-dozen clinics in rural Kenya, hopping from one village to another by helicopter. They assigned us only one battered chopper, and that at Tachyon's insistence. The government would have much preferred that we spend our time lecturing at the university, meeting with educators and political leaders, touring game preserves and museums. Most of my fellow delegates were only too glad to comply. The wild card is 40 years old, and we've grown used to it. But AIDS? That is a new terror in the world, and one that we have only begun to understand. At home, it is thought of as a homosexual affliction, and I confess that I am guilty of thinking of it that way myself. But here, in Africa, that belief is given the lie. Already there are more AIDS victims on this continent alone than were ever infected by the Tekesian xenovirus since its release over Manhattan 40 years ago. And AIDS seems a crueler demon somehow. The wild card kills 90% of those who draw it, often in ways that are terrible and painful. But the distance between 90% and 100 is not insignificant if you are among the 10 who live. It is the distance between life and death, between hope and despair. Some claim that it's better to die than to live as a joker, but you will not find me among their number. If my own life has not always been happy, nonetheless, I have memories I cherish and accomplishments I am proud of. I am glad to have lived, and I do not want to die. I've accepted my death, but that does not mean I welcome it. I have too much unfinished business. Like Robert Tomlin, I have not yet seen the Jolson story. None of us have. In Kenya, we saw whole villages that are dying. Alive, smiling, talking, capable of eating and defecating and making love and even babies. Alive to all practical purposes. And yet dead. Those who draw the Black Queen may die in the agony of unspeakable transformations, but there are drugs for pain, and at least they die quickly. AIDS is less merciful. We have much in common, Jokers and AIDS victims. Before I left Jokertown, we'd been planning for a JDL fundraising benefit at the Funhouse in late May, a major event with as much big-name entertainment as we could book. After Kenya, I cabled instructions back to New York to arrange for the proceeds of the benefit to be split with a suitable AIDS victims group. We pariahs need to stick together. Perhaps I can still erect a few necessary bridges before my own Black Queen lies face up on the table.
Down by the Nile, by Gail Gerstner Miller. Read for you by Kathleen Turner. The torches in the temple burned slowly, steadily, occasionally flickering when someone passed by. Their light illuminated the faces of the people gathered in a small antechamber off the main hall. They were all present, those who looked like ordinary people, and the others who were extraordinary. The catwoman, the jackal-headed man, those with wings, crocodile skin, and bird heads. Osiris, the farseer, spoke. The winged one comes. Is she one of us? Will she help us? Not directly, Osiris answered. But within her is that which will have the power to do great things. For now, we must wait. We have waited a very long time, said Anubis the jackal. A little longer will not make a difference. The others murmured in agreement. The living gods settled back to patiently wait. The room in Luxor's Winter Palace Hotel was sweltering, and it was still only morning. The ceiling fan stirred the sluggish air tiredly, and sweat ran in trickling rivulets over Peregrine's ribcage and breasts as she lay propped up in bed, watching Josh McCoy slip a new film cassette into his camera. He looked at her and smiled. "We'd better get going," he said. She smiled back lazily from the bed, her wings moving gently, bringing more coolness into the room than the slow-moving fan. If you say so. She stood, stretched lightly, and watched McCoy watch her. She walked by him, dancing out of his way as he reached for her. Haven't you had enough yet? She asked teasingly, as she took a clean pair of jeans from her suitcase. She wiggled into them, batting her wings to keep her balance. The hotel laundry must have washed these in boiling water. She took a deep breath and pulled on the stubborn zipper. There. They look great, though, McCoy said. He put his arms around her from behind, and Peregrine shivered as he kissed the back of her neck and caressed her breasts, still sensitive from their morning lovemaking. I thought you said we had to get going. She settled back against him. McCoy sighed and pulled away reluctantly. We do. We have to meet the others in... He checked his wristwatch. 3 minutes. Too bad, Peregrine said, smiling mischievously. I think I could be coaxed into spending all day in bed. Work awaits, McCoy said, rummaging for his clothes as Peregrine put on a tank top. And I'm anxious to see if these self-proclaimed living gods can do all they claim. She watched him as he dressed, admiring his lean, muscular body. He was blonde and fit, a documentary filmmaker and cameraman, and a wonderful lover. Got everything? Don't forget your hat. The sun's fierce, even if it is winter. I've got everything I need, Peregrine said, with a sidelong glance. Let's go. McCoy turned the Do Not Disturb sign hanging on the door handle to the other side, then closed and locked the door. The hotel corridor was quiet and deserted. Takyun must have heard their muffled footsteps because he poked his head out as they passed his room. Morning, Taki, Peregrine said. Josh, Father Squid, Hiram and I are going to catch the afternoon ceremony at the Temple of the Living Gods. Want to come along? Good morning, my dear. Takyun, looking resplendent in a white brocade dressing gown, nodded distantly to McCoy. No, thank you. I'll see everything I need to see at the meeting tonight. Right now, it's much too hot to venture out. Takyun looked closely at her. Are you feeling all right? You look pale. I think the heat's getting to me, too, Peregrine replied. That, and the food, and the water, or rather the microbes that live in them. We don't need you getting sick, Takyun said seriously. Coming, let me do a quick examination. He fanned his face. We'll find out what's bothering you, and it will give me something useful to do with my day. We don't have the time right now. The others are waiting for us. Perry, McCoy interrupted, a concerned look on his face. It'll only take a few minutes. I'll go downstairs and tell Hiram and Father Squid you've been delayed. She hesitated. Please, he added. Oh, all right, she smiled at him. I'll see you downstairs. McCoy nodded and continued down the hallway as Peregrine followed Takyun into his ornately appointed suite. The sitting room was spacious and much cooler than the room she shared with McCoy. Of course, she reflected. They had generated a lot of heat themselves that morning. Wow, she commented, glancing around the luxuriously decorated room. I must have gotten the servants' quarters. It's really something, isn't it? I especially like the bed. Takyun pointed to a large four-poster draped with white netting that was visible through the bedroom's open door. You have to climb steps to get into it. What fun! He glanced at her mischievously. Want to try it out? No, thanks. I've already had my morning sex. Perry, Takyun complained in a teasing tone. I don't understand why you're attracted to that man. He retrieved his red leather medical bag from the closet. Sit there, he said, indicating a plush velvet wingback chair. And open your mouth. Say, Peregrine repeated obediently after seating herself. Takyun peered down her throat. Well, that looks nice and healthy. He swiftly examined her ears and looked into her eyes. Seems okay. Tell me about your symptoms. He removed his stethoscope from his bag. Nausea? Vomiting, dizziness, some nausea and vomiting. When? After you eat? No, not really. Anytime. Do you get sick every day? No, maybe a couple of times a week. He lifted her shirt up and held his stethoscope against her left breast. She jumped at the touch of cold steel against her warm flesh. Sorry. Heartbeat is strong and regular. How long has this vomiting been occurring? A couple of months, I guess. Since before the tour started. I thought it was stress-related. He frowned. You've been vomiting for a couple of months, and you didn't see fit to consult me. I am your doctor. She squirmed uncomfortably. Taki, you've been so busy. I didn't want to bother you. I think it's all the traveling, the food, the different water, different standards of hygiene. Allow me to make the diagnosis, if you please, young lady. Are you getting enough sleep, or is your new boyfriend keeping you up all hours?